So then here is that because it's been said in the negative that, the material life, everybody's losing, their life, and it's just a waste of time, except those who are hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. So here then someone says, no, but everyone's getting results because they see that a person works, he's getting money, he's getting a house, he's getting facilities, he's becoming well situated and famous and influential and all these different things like that. But here it's being said now, quoting from Bhagavatam, do not the trees live long life? Do not the bellows breathe? Do not the village animals and animal-like men eat and mate? Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.18. So here's pointing out as, yeah, I mean, it's all these things that you don't even consider as important, then they're going on. So what's the difference? Udriti, Srila Prabhupada. The materialistic man of the modern age will argue that life, or part of it, is never meant for discussion of theosophical or theological arguments. Life is meant for the maximum duration of existence, for eating, drinking, sexual intercourse, making merry, and enjoying life. The modern man wants to live forever by the advancement of material science, and there are many foolish theories for prolonging life to the maximum duration. It's kind of interesting that before you go back some years, and that was very much the thing, science is going to, life's going to get longer, it's going to get better and this and that. You don't so much hear him talking about that these days. Everything's kind of getting shorter, everything's falling apart. It doesn't seem to be as proper. But, the individual thinks like that, he wants to live forever. But the Srimad Bhagavatam affirms that life is not meant for so-called economic development or advancement of materialistic science for the hedonistic philosophy of eating, mating, drinking, and merrymaking. Life is solely meant for tapasya, for purifying existence, so that one may enter into eternal life just after the end of the human form of life. Right? So the tapasya means the performance of duties. And what is the ultimate duties? That means dharma. What is the ultimate dharma? Sad-dharma. That is that worship of the Supreme Lord. So human life is meant for worshiping the Supreme Lord. If that's going on, then it actually is human life. And if not, it's human form of life. It's not human life. The materialists want to prolong life as much as possible, because they have no information of the next life. They want to get the maximum comforts in this present life because they think conclusively that there's no life after death. This ignorance about the eternality of the living being and the change of covering in the material world has played havoc in the structure of modern human society. Consequently, there are many problems multiplied by various plans of modernized men. The plans for solving the problems of society have only aggravated the troubles. Even if it is possible to prolong life more than 100 years, advancement of human civilization does not necessarily follow. Right? It means even if you can, prolong life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the advancement of human civilization follows. Just because you live long doesn't mean that you get anything more. Yeah. So the problem is they don't understand this basic science of the nature of the soul, the eternality of your soul, the relationship with the Supreme Lord, the material world, its nature, that relationship with the soul and the living entity and the Supreme Lord. Then what is that process that the human life, because it's meant for spiritual realization, what is that process? So it's bhakti, it's the abhideya, and the prayojana is to develop love for God. Without knowing this, then they come up with so many plans, as Prabhupada says. And these plans just cause more and more problems. That's all. It's not that their materialistic plan has solved anything. Whatever it is, it just creates another problem. Like I'm noticing in, England, because they have that kind of socialistic aspect, which is more popular in Europe. So it becomes basically kind of like a welfare state. So all the health care and everything's free, which is a very nice thing. But at the same time, is where does that money come from? So that has to come from the taxes and everything like that. You know, and the people don't like the high taxes, but the point is those taxes pay for all these free things they get, free education, free healthcare. You know, the roads are taken care of. You don't have to do anything for that. You know, all these different things. The police are out there. So many things are going on. And so those are all taken care of by the taxes. And that means then people have to be making money. At the same time, as then we see is that someone to make money, like I just was seeing that there's a restaurant chain now that in, I think it's in America, that now you come and you make the order and a robot puts together all the food. So they've gotten rid of people. So this robot does it. They're like, oh, they're very nice, you know, very modern. But now that's at least means, and that robot will work all day. And so that might be one shift, it might be two shifts, you know, and like that. And so by this doing, at least 100, if not 200 people are now out of a job. And so this one guy is supposedly making more money because he doesn't have to pay these people. But now there's less people that have money to go to his place and buy something to eat. So that's the point, is as they make their plans to do all these things, then nothing works. You know, it's just like if you want to see a doctor, you just go see a doctor. You might have to make an appointment after a few days or something. But then on that social system, because it's all free and you have to see specific doctors, and every 3 months they can give you an appointment. And if you miss your appointment, it's another 3 months later. So that means something happened, you got stuck in traffic, and now after 6 months only, then you can meet that doctor. So whatever it is, the plans they make, they always have problems. That's the thing. And so no matter what you do, even you lengthen life, you do this, that, you make all these plans, still people will not be satisfied because they're not addressing the real need, which is the need of the soul, that they are part and parcel of the Lord. And that the actual process for the living being is not economic development, sense gratification, and even religious activities or liberation, but is devotional service to the Supreme Lord. That's the real purpose of a living entity. The Bhagavatam says that certain trees live for hundreds and thousands of years. At Vrindavan, there is a tamarind tree, a place known as Imlitala, which is said to have existed since the time of Lord Krishna. In the Calcutta Botanical Garden, there is a banyan tree said to be older than 500 years. And there are many such trees all over the world. Swami Shankaracharya lived only 32 years, and Lord Chaitanya lived 48 years. Does it mean that the prolonged lives of the above-mentioned trees are more important than Shankara or Chaitanya? Prolonged life without spiritual value is not very important. One may doubt that trees have life because they do not breathe. But modern scientists like Bosch have already proved that there is life in plants. So breathing is no sign of actual life. Bhagavatam says that the bellows of the blacksmith breathes very soundly, but that does not mean that the bellows has life. The materialists will argue that life in the tree and life in the man cannot be compared because the tree cannot enjoy life by eating palatable dishes or by enjoying sexual intercourse. In reply to this, the Bhagavatam asks whether other animals like the dogs and hogs living in the same village with human beings do not eat and enjoy sexual life. The specific utterance of Srimad Bhagavatam in regard to quote-unquote other animals means that persons who are simply engaged in planning a better type of animal life consisting of eating, breathing, and mating are also animals in the shape of human beings. The society of such polished animals cannot benefit suffering humanity. For an animal can easily harm another animal, but rarely do good. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.18. Yeah, so that's the point, is all these plans, if they're not connected to the Krishna, they're not development. So this whole idea that the first world is so much more developed and so much more this, but to what advantage? It's not that the human form of life has now come to a better platform, that they are more God conscious or anything. No, in fact, you see a lot that they're not. Like Europe, you know, much of Europe then, you know, be taken as first world. But you notice the part of Europe that's first world tends to be atheistic. And then the parts of Europe that are not, that are second world, and that they tend to be more religious. So you're going to have this difficulty is that they use, one says that they're more developed and all that, they're first world, but what are they first world in? What are they leading in? And simply, like it says here, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That's it. They're just polished animals. So at the end of life, what benefit will they get? That karma's done, they move on to something else. Who knows what they'll become? Then Jiva Goswami continues, do not the animals and others, people who are like animals, pare, mate, mehanti, right? So, you know, the point is no, but, you know, they're superior, you know, like that, you know, we're making life, you know, like that by science, we're making life and, you know, and we're protecting life and developing life. But the trees live for hundreds, thousands of years, you know, like that. And, oh, but, you know, like they said, they don't breathe, but, you know, do the bellows not breathe? So they now have something better? No, but, you know, all the glorious of life, you know, the eating, the fine eating, the, you know, wining, dining, all these different things they can't do. It says, but do not the animals that live with around the humans, do they not eat and also then mate? So what's the point? What's the point is that it's all going on, but it's, we've decided that this is great and glorious, but in actuality, then no. Anything on that or no? Anucheta 35. Then it is said, men who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and asses, praise those men who never listen to the transcendental pastimes of Lord Krishna, the deliverer from evils. Srimad Bhagavatam 2:3:19. You know, so then you'll say no, but so many people glorify it. Then he's saying, which people glorify? Udriti. Srila Prabhupada. So Srimad Bhagavatam's categorization of the common man without any spiritual enlightenment into the society of dogs, hogs, camels, and asses is not at all an exaggeration. It's just. The leaders of such ignorant masses of people may feel very proud of being adored by such a number of dogs and hogs, but that is not very flattering. The Bhagavatam openly declares that although a person may be a great leader of such dogs and hogs disguised as men, if he has no taste for being enlightened in the science of Krishna, such a leader is also an animal and nothing more. That means he has followers who are, you know, hogs, dogs, camels, and asses, and it comes into that category. So he's glorified amongst those persons, but not amongst those who are actually enlightened in spiritual life. He may be designated as a powerful, strong animal or a big animal, but in the estimation of Srimad Bhagavatam, he is never given a place in the category of man on account of his atheistic temperament. Right, so if you're not God conscious, you're not considered human. You're in the human form of life, but you're just a two-legged animal. Or, in other words, such godless leaders of dogs and hog-like men are bigger animals with the qualities of animals in greater proportion. Srimad Bhagavatam 2:3:19 purport. So it's just that since you have a society of animals, then whoever is the bigger animal then will be glorified by the smaller animals. You know, it's just like everybody wants money, so someone with money is glorified by the people who have less money. You know, so everyone wants beauty, so someone is more beautiful or more influential or, you know, whatever it is, then people who desire that. So therefore, in a society of hogs, dogs, camels, and asses, whoever is the biggest in these fields will be glorified. And so that's all. It's just amongst animals. Srila Jiva Goswami continues. The human who is praised lavishly, some stutaha, by associates who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and donkeys, is an animal. If he is the best among them, he is just a great animal. Right? He's the best amongst them. He's praised by animals. He's the best amongst them. So he's the best animal. Anucheta 36 through 40. Five verses show how the limbs of the materialist are useless. Sutta, how lamentable. The ears of a person who has not heard the glories of the Lord are like snake holes. The tongue which does not chant the glories of the Lord is as offensive as a frog's tongue. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.20. The ears of a person who has not heard about the Lord are useless holes, snake holes. The tongue is wicked, asati, if it does not chant the Lord's glories. Then next verse. The head decorated with turban and crown, which does not bow to Krishna, is simply a heavy weight which will sink the person in samsara. Right? Like if you're in the river and you're going and you have a great weight, you sink. Remember, there was this one, story was going on, is that a bunch of, not pilgrims, they were, people were going from the one side of America to the other side. So then they're going in their wagon trains and all that. They come to a river. And, because there weren't any bridges and stuff at that time, they had to find wherever was the, best location to cross. And that's where they went across. And so you took the wagon trains. They went in the water. The carousels go in the water. People didn't know how to swim, this, that. So as they're going, then, in that party, one guy drowns. And they can't figure out why, because no one else drowned. But then when they dragged him out, then they found out he was wearing this huge kind of belt thing, and it was full of gold. So it was so heavy that it just weighed him down, and he couldn't stay afloat. So even though the gold is so valuable, and anybody, had that much gold, they would be in a very, very good position. But all it does is weigh you down and you drown. So that's the thing. The material world is, you may have all these nice things, but you just sink in samsara. So then what's the point for the human being? The animals are already in the samsara. They're getting the benefits. The human is supposed to get out, not create a new cycle of samsara. Okay, Bhagavatam verse continues. The hands which do not make offerings to the Lord, though decorated with glittering gold bangles, are those of a dead person. Because there's no life. Life means that of the soul. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.21. The head decorated with, it's just like if you empower something with electricity, the toaster, you still don't say it's alive. So in the same way as you have the body, the subtle body, which is made of the 24 elements, which are dead matter, you empower that with potencies from the universal form. And so therefore it moves around, walks, talks, and does all kinds of stuff. But that still doesn't mean that it's alive. It's still dead. The gross and subtle bodies are still dead. And if the soul identifies with that, then it's identifying on the platform of dead matter. A head decorated with a turban or crown is simply a weight. Api means or. Next verse. Men's eyes which do not see the form of the Lord are like the eyes on the peacock feather, and they fall on the thorny field of samsara. Men's feet which do not walk to the places of the Lord are like the bases of trees to be cut by the axes of Yamadutas, right? Because the bases of trees, they don't move. They don't walk around, even though that's their feet, right? Technically, it's their feet. It means they have, unique feet for themselves. But that's their feet. And so basically it just means that they'll be chopped down at that point, by the Yamadutas, because they don't go, so they'll just die. Feet which do not go to the temple are like the bases of trees. Duruma janma bhajao. Next verse. That person who does not smear his body with the dust from the devotee's feet is a corpse whose offerings are not accepted by the Lord. That person does not smell the fragrance of the tulasi on Vishnu's feet is similarly a ghost. I've said tula shan. Okay. Tulasi on. Is similarly a ghost. you know, and it seems to be he's moving, but it's just a ghost. Ghost has no purpose, you know, nothing it can do, accomplish like that. So here is that it says, even if they're offering to the Lord, if they don't accept the devotees, then the Lord doesn't really accept their offering. That's why then it's important that they come in contact with devotees, with the parampara, and then hearing from them and associating with them, then they're making their offerings, then there's real value to that association, to that activity. Otherwise, then no, there's no real benefit. A person who has not attained the dust attached to the Lord's feet is a corpse. Because unless one is connected with devotees, then one is not actually alive. Alive means you're connected with devotees. That's real life. Because as we saw before, Sridhar Swami is pointing out, is only by the association of devotees does anything become of value. So we see again here, he's bringing it up, that people will say, oh no, but we're doing this, we're doing that, and so many things are being accomplished. And the Bhagavatam is just going through one after another and pointing out, no, it's just, what's the difference between that and the hogs, dogs, camels, and asses, the trees, the bellows, you know, all this. Next verse. That heart which does not transform on hearing the names of the Lord, tears in the eyes and hair standing on end, is made of iron. Srimad Bhagavatam 2:324. Like that. So we see is that comes up in the Bhagavatam also, that discussion, and Krishna's Kaviraj, he says that my iron encased stone like heart. So it means you got the stone like heart. Here he's just saying it's like the you know, that. Then you're covering that in iron like that. Jiva Goswami. That's Bhagavatam 2:324. The heart which does not transform is hard, saram, like iron. When there is transformation, there will be tears in the eyes. Prickett will confirm this later. So from Bhagavatam. Actual speech is that which describes the qualities of the Lord. Real hands are those that work for him. A true mind is that which always remembers him. Dwelling within everything, moving and non-moving. And actual ears are those that listen to sanctifying topics about him. An actual head is one that bows down to the Lord in his manifestations among the moving and non-moving creatures. Real eyes are those that see only the Lord. And actual limbs are those which regularly honor the water that has bathed the Lord's feet or those of his devotees. Srimad Bhagavatam 10:8-3-4. So we see here that Prickett Maharaj is actually describing what is the proper thing, because it's gone through all these things on you know, the head, the feet, the eyes of it. And then you say, what is the real thing? And so this is that. Jiva Goswami continues. Thus, in the chapter where Sukadeva begins speaking, bhakti is mentioned as the Abhideya. The commentary says, in the first chapter of the second canto, it is explained that one should concentrate the mind on the universal form of the Lord. In the second chapter, it is explained that the controlled mind should meditate on Vishnu, the witness of all beings, the Lord of all beings, rather than the universal form. In the third chapter, the superiority of Shaunaka's bhakti and engagement in hearing about the activities of the Lord with great devotion are described. Shaunaka spoke thus the verses. So first he's saying is you don't have any idea, then you meditate on the universal form. Then you should meditate on Vishnu, because he's the one who's all this universal form, all this is under his control. And then you go about that devotion to the Lord, him as a person, and then that goes. So in other words, you're starting off the Brahman in the first chapter. You know, the second chapter then is Paramatma, and then in the third chapter, then he's describing the glories of worship of Bhagavan. So then that's the process that you take it through. Yes. Anything
Maharaj,
on this?
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Guru Maharaj, now you was reading Srimad Bhagavatam 2:324. And there in purport, Srila Prabhupada described the concept of five devatas. And as I heard, this concept was created by Shankaracharya. Srila Prabhupada mentioned it a few times in his comments. And I want to ask why Shankaracharya told that these five devatas, they are gods, and all other devatas are demigods. Especially question is about Ganesh, why he was in a category of god and other in demigods.
So he's just, in other words, pointing out that these are, in other words, these are your five main demigods, and everybody else is going to be then therefore in support of those demigods. You know, so you're going to get that aspect of that for them and for their process, because they have to meditate on the Supreme. So in other words, he's giving them basically something, so even the universal form might be difficult. So this is then where you're looking at aspects of the universe, and you're looking at the five levels of consciousness through these five deities. And so, but the idea is to go up through the consciousness, because that's what we see in the Upanishads. It's always you're going up. It means if you're on level one, you're trying to get to level five. It's not that I'm on one, I'm conscious, so that's good enough. You're always trying to elevate. And so then you'll take it through to five. You know, so that means worship of Vishnu. But those who are materialistic in that, then they'll just see, you know, him as a manifestation of the mode of goodness. And so they won't actually come to the proper understanding. But at least they've been, they'll identify as Vaishnavas, they worship Vishnu and all that. Now, if they come in contact with a pure devotee as opposed to a Shankarite, then they will actually learn the actual truth, and then they will be able to progress on very nicely. So then you see that. So many times that those who, you know, come from smarter backgrounds, when they come in contact with the devotees, then they already have, everything's in place in their life. They're already, means before they join, they were getting up in the Brahma Muhurta, taking their bath, you know, doing whatever their pujas and all that, you know, making their offerings, only taking prasad. They were doing all that before, but they weren't doing it under the direction of the pure Vaishnavas. Now that they've come in contact with the pure Vaishnavas, they just now adjust that to its actual position of worship of Krishna. And so then now they get that full benefit. So that's the idea. It takes them up through that. And so then point is otherwise people will go after everything. Oh, but he could get this from here. And oh, but that could, it's just like people going on the internet and trying to figure out how to be healthy. Everybody's got an opinion. There's a million ways to do something. Like if you're doing fasting, how many ways to fast are? And what can you fast on? And each one will say, this is the best. So then you're going to get bewildered, right? So therefore, forget all the other 33 million demigods. Just concentrate on these five. So that's his thing. He's reducing it from everything down to five. And then it's supposed to be that five down to one, to Vishnu. So he's hidden the whole process. In other words, his job was to bewilder the Buddhists and bring them into the Vedic, you know, understanding. But then in that, he's left the door open for them to move forward into pure devotional service. Whether they will or not is another thing, but he's left the door open. So therefore, then when Ramanujacharya comes and Madhvacharya, then they try to convince them of this, how to move forward into pure devotion. Does that make any sense?
Yes, Guru Maharaj, thank you very much. I want to understand what is the basis of categorization of I can understand why Shankaracharya mentioned here Lord Shiva and Durga Devi, like his transformation and the energy of Lord Vishnu, and Surya Dev is the eye of Lord Narayana. But why Ganesh was also put here?
But Ganesh, he means you're dealing with the sun as, yes, the eye of the Lord, but also then prosperity and all that. What it means, what you can see is probably the easiest thing to do is go into the Brahma Samhita. And there's five verses there which go through each one of these five in the Panchopasana and then show their connection with the Lord. And then there'll be the purports that are there by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So then that will give the explanation, because the point is how does he remove the obstacles of the universe? How does he make things auspicious? Because Ganesh keeps the lotus feet of Lord Nrisimhadev on his head. Right, and he's a North Indian elephant, you know, so it has those two bumps on the head, those two round bumps, And so those are tumalai. So he keeps one foot on each. Right? In South India, they just have this more small forehead, kind of smooth. They look very beautiful, the South Indian ones, but they don't, the bigger ones, I mean, the North Indian ones have these, you know, bigger heads with these like that. They considered that they understand more, the North Indian elephants. So he's one of that kind of elephant. And so then he keeps Lord Nrisimhadev's feet on his head. That's how he can remove the obstacles of the universe and create prosperity. So he's connected to the Lord. He's a devotee of the Lord. You know? So that, and then we see, you know, he's expanding from, so those who don't worship demigods like the Shris, then they worship, instead of Ganesh, they worship Vishwakshena. So Vishwakshena has expanded as Ganesh. You know, and for us specifically, we worship the Guru, because by the grace of the Guru, then Krishna is pleased, and then all these auspicious, nice things happen. Like that. So all obstacles are removed by surrendering to the devotees. So that will be his position. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Guru Maharaj. And also, I want to ask one question regarding the system, because I saw in a different comments of Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Ganesh and Suryadev, they changed places. In one place, Suryadev was the deity of Pranamoy Kosha, and Ganesh the deity of Gyanamoy Kosha. And in another classification, they changed it, and Ganesh was on the level of deity of Pranamoy Kosha and Suryadev deity of Gyanamoy Kosha. And what is the correct?
That means that they both can be correct. It's just a matter of how people are looking at the thing. If you're looking at Ganesh, means you have Surya and Ganesh. So the Pranamoy aspect is that you're looking at groups of people and all that. Does that make sense? So you have people that, you know, save the blue whale and all this kind of stuff. And okay, so that's dealing with gunas. They don't care about anybody else. They only care about the blue whale, you know, or they only care about their community. You know what I'm saying? So as you go around the world, they only care about that, you know. Each community mm-hmm. could get rid of the other community quite happily. So that'll be Ganapatya, right, on that level. And at the same time as then if you see it as, you know, then Gana is that you're taking shelter of the Lord and this and that, following his laws, so then you become a Gana of following the Lord's laws, a theistic aspect. Does that make sense? So it's just a matter of how you're seeing it. And then same with the sun. You see those who are more sentimental. It's not just one group. They're not so political. The political ones go for one group. The less political ones, it's just all people, all of the world. You get those kind of people. They're very nice, pleasant people. They generally never get anything done. They're so sentimental. But they're very pleasant to be around because they care about everybody and try to help everybody in that. So that'll be that Surya aspect. And then if you see it, that all life is coming from the Lord, all potency is coming from the Lord, that pervades everything. Everything's going on by the Lord's grace and everything like that. And then you're seeing that aspect of Surya. So it just depends upon the mentality, those two switch, but that you're dealing with the matter, the senses and the sense objects. And that's going to be Durga. It doesn't matter which sense object and that, it's going to be Durga. And you're dealing on the platform that we're not the gross material elements. We're beyond that. And so then, you're going to be try to free yourself from the material entanglement. That's going to be Shiva. It doesn't matter what form it is. Like you see, even the Buddhists worship Lord Shiva. So as long as there's that idea of that kind of impersonal aspect, giving up the material, it's going to be dealing with Shiva. Well, as soon as you're dealing beyond the material, the transcendental, that personal, then you're going to be dealing with Vishnu. Because he's the actual one who makes it all work. So then Lord Brahma points out how these five main deities, these Panchapastana deities, then how they are then related to Vishnu. So that's the whole idea, is that you can either worship so many demigods, but you can't do that. So in other words, if you're going to worship any of them, you have to worship them all. How do you worship 33 million? No? So then it's been cut down to this five. You worship these five. But technically, even these five, you can't worship unless you worship them in context of Vishnu. So when you're doing the worship of these deities, you actually have to worship Vishnu Shaligram. And then after worshiping, then those items are offered to that particular deity that you're worshiping. And so therefore, once you would come to the point, okay, you got rid of all the demigods, now it's down to these five. But these four, you can only worship in contact of Vishnu. And Vishnu, you can worship on his own. You don't need the other four to worship him. So therefore, then if you're intelligent, you think, well, he's actually the main one. He's the actual, he's the supreme God. In other words, he's the supreme God. These are gods and everybody else is demigods. That make sense?
Yes, yes, Guru Maharaj, thank you very much. And one last question on this topic. This Panchopasana system was created by Shankaracharya. And for us, as for Vaishnavas, is it an authoritative system? Because we see some of our acharyas used it for some explanation. Or we can't consider it authoritative because it doesn't have roots in a Vedic...
It's a Vedic system. It's a Vedic system. Otherwise, why did Brahma pick out these five deities? It's a Vedic system. You know, that's then the smartest go for that. It's just a Shankara. But just like impersonalism is not created by Shankaracharya. It was there before. I mean, 5,000 years ago, then you had Sukadeva Goswami. He was an impersonalist. Then he became a personalist. You go back before that, at the beginning of creation, the four Kumaras were impersonalist. Then they became personalists. Right? And impersonal doesn't mean they don't accept the form. Like the four Kumaras wanted to go see the form of the Lord, even though they were impersonalists, because everything's Brahman, here's the supreme Brahman, and you know, so it's all Brahman, they just see Brahman. And so then they wanted to see the supreme Brahman, and then only after seeing, when they bowed down and offered their respects, when they smelled the tulsi at the lotus feet of the Lord, then they understood this is transcendental ecstasy, because they're so well situated in the Brahman platform that there's no time that their senses and sense objects interact for any pleasure, and here they're getting this ecstatic pleasure, and so they understand this is beyond material, so this must be spiritual pleasure. So then they took up bhakti. So impersonal is there, but the Mayavad, as he's given it, that is, you're taking from a little bit here and there and twisting and not. Basically, all he's doing is taking Buddhism and putting it into Vedic terminologies and quoting Vedic verses instead of using Buddhist terminologies and quoting, you know, the Buddhist scriptures. That's all. So therefore, he's trying to bring them close. You know, he's just bringing them from being atheistic over to having the aspect of at least being the theistic, that they accept the Vedas and following the Lord's rules, you know, because it comes from the Shastra. Then he's leaving the door open to go farther, but he has to bewilder the Buddhist and that they accept it. So it has to be a good job. He has to be convincing. But anybody who's smart in a good association, then they will see as, no, there's more. He only took it up to a particular level. Now, then the Vaishnavas bring it to its actual platform.
Okay? Thank you very much, Maharaj. Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask some? It's okay.
Please, please.
So the Sridhar Swami's commentary reminded me of something. When we were studying through the 11th chapter of Gita last time, I had this idea that maybe the reason Krishna showed the forearm form after the universal form before he showed his two-arm form was because of this Brahman Paramatma Bhagavan aspect. But I didn't have time to go through and verify it. Do you think there might be something to that?
Definitely, because you're showing that that here is all these wonderful opulences. I mean, because you've seen three explanations, I think, in the what is it, 9th, or is it 10th, 11th, 9, 10, 11, or something. There's three chapters there in the Gita where each one is describing certain aspects. The Acharyas mentioned what's the difference. One of them, I think, is vibhutis. One of them is the different things. So there's some difference on the three explanations. So all on the universal form to establish that everything's connected to the Lord. So it's all, therefore, has that aspect of Brahman. But then it's not that it's just Brahman and that's it. It's a personal. There is a person who manages that. And it's that person managing that. But then why is he managing that? That is, therefore, then the desire of the Lord of Bhagavan. So then you bring it to there. So yes, I would say is that whatever Krishna does, is he accomplishes many things. So it might be, I mean, there that aspect is there. There might be some other aspects of the Lord, that the Acharyas explained also, because then you're going from the one into the next into the next. So we see ourselves as that, you know, it's all connected to Krishna, but then it's all connected with the Lord is controlling all this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the Acharyas mostly focused on that to point out that Krishna is the original source, so Vishnu came from him, and then also so did the.
Yes, I would say that. So it's doing that, what you're talking about, but it has that particular angle. Instead of just as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, but showing that Bhagavan is the origin. Therefore, then you have Paramatma and then expanding that. You know, in other words, Paramatma enters everything and expands as everything. And so what has been expanded, that's the Brahman part.
Right.
Yes, yeah, so it would be like the Bhagavat Sandarbha. It's talking about Brahman, but how it's connected is coming from the Lord. How it's coming from Bhagavan is his effulgence. So even you're dealing with these mechanical details, but the point is that these details still have a purpose, and that is to Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam.
Right.
So that's why even we're quoting from the scriptures, but we have to, what is the purpose of our quoting? What are we actually trying to establish? That's why then you see sometimes two different people are quoting the same verse and getting two different meanings out of it. But what's the purpose of that? What are they trying to establish by that? That's what has to be seen, because that's the real thing. What's their intent? Like we said before, there's the time, there's the space, but there's in the intent. You know, and he probably gives some other term, but there's, you know, I mean, you have the circumstance. So that's the person. What's the intent of that person? How do they view? How do they value? So when they see the space, then they become inspired in that space. This activity could be performed and get this result. Therefore, they apply time. So that circumstance is the person and their intent. So when that person is a devotee, and his interest is in pure devotion, therefore then all time and all space is then used in connection to the Lord. So that's also then said in the fourth verse of the Chaturshloki, is that time and space, and all times and all places, then you should see everything in connection with the Lord. You know, see everything in connection with the Lord. Then, yes, you see is that how the Brahman and how he's controlling it, but ultimately how he is the person. That's the important thing, and that he is beyond all this. Therefore, you can just why connect with just him, how he controls the three worlds? Why not connect with him, how he has his pastimes in pure devotion with his great devotees? Is that good?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so always that intent has to be seen, because people talk about the time and space, and then they don't know what the intent is. So then they'll project the in other words, their own intent. So that's why we have to learn intent from the great devotees. In that situation, what did Vidura do? In that situation, what did Arjuna do or Yudhishthir do? In that situation, you know, what did all these, you know, Draupadi and Kunti and Prahlad Maharaj, what did they do? You know, that's the thing that's important, because then you see what's their intent in that situation, and you take that up. not that, oh, they did something in this situation, so this situation is bona fide. What's the intent? That has to be seen. So that's why when they say time, place, circumstances, they take it circumstances just means it's a variation of place and time. They don't take it that circumstance means them. You know, the person is going, oh, but you know, you talk all about Vedic, but it's modern age, time, place, circumstance. What they mean is I'm not counting my own intent that I don't want to follow the Vedic. So I'm interpreting it this way. But then what's your purpose? Why say, you know, like we're saying, why say we're you know, not Indians, we're Westerners. What's the intent? What are they trying to establish by using that intent? Then they're quoting the Shastras and quoting from Prabhupada and this and that. But their intent is based on, you know, we're Westerners. What's the intent? What do they want to establish? That we don't have to follow because I don't want to follow. So the circumstance means the person or persons involved and what is their motive in being involved. What's their what do they want to gain by being involved? That must be seen. So then that's always going to separate off, is that then the pure devotees can see the Lord and how he controls everything, but they see it in context of Krishna, the person, and what will be pleasurable to him. You know, and then you apply the appropriate mechanics. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so then that ends that anuchedas. And so then we'll stop here for today. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.